All right, well, enough of that. 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel starting in chapter 18, and I am going to be ambitious this evening. I told my wife when we were walking up here, I think we're actually going to cover 3 entire chapters tonight. Laugh all you want, but I think we might be able to do it. So let's pray and we'll dive into this. Father, again, thank you for the Word of God, your Word, the Scriptures, the Bible. What we have is indeed that, your very word for us, inspired by your Holy Spirit, God-breathed for our growth, our edification, to challenge us, to provide examples for us on both how to be and how to not be, especially in this chapter here, in chapter 18, going into chapters 19 and 20, to look at the lives of some of these individuals from history and what they did, what their part was in the history of Israel and what their part was before you and how they walked before you. We can learn from these folks. So we ask for your blessing on this time. Again, we thank you that we can meet. Thank you for this building. Thank you for your provision. In Jesus' precious name, amen. So, really interesting section here, chapters 18, 19, and 20, largely dealing with David and Saul, and then Saul's immediate family. And so kind of some interpersonal sorts of things and how David is central to all of that. So chapter 18, pick it up here in verse 1. Now when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Verse 2, Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. And then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. So the context there in verse 1, we had finished speaking with Saul. This is David from chapter 17. Of course, after the battle over the Philistines upon the defeat of Goliath, remember that Saul was asking, this is verse 56 of chapter 17, like, whose kid is this? Like, you know, whose young man is this? Who is this kid? So Abner doesn't have any idea who it is. And David answers at the end of the chapter, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. So when he had finished speaking with him, so here's now Jonathan. And I love this there in verse 1, the soul of Jonathan. Notice just the great word picture here. Was knit, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. A quick note in verse 2 before we talk about verses 1 and 3. Does this sound familiar? Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore, because remember chapter 8? What were the kings going to do? We can take your sons, take your daughters, and then they will be there for the bidding of the king. So as for verses 1 and 3, this great love between these two men, I'll tell you, as soon as those words come out of my mouth, our world wants to just debase and ruin everything. And this wonderful, beautiful friendship here is no different. The world wants to make something detestable out of this. And really, and I remember hearing someone describe this, that this is among the highest forms of human love on display. Like, why and how? Because these two men, these two friends, were interested in the other friend. They were interested in the friendship. There was nothing to gain other than the friendship itself. Nothing physical, you know, nothing emotional in that sense. It was just these two men that had so much in common and loved one another. And of course, how much they had in common. They're so like-minded. They were obviously men of faith. I mean, we spent some time, a couple weeks in chapter 17, not just faith of David, but the daring of David and the daring of Jonathan earlier with his armor bearer. Like, hey, let's go see what the Lord might do. It may be that the Lord might deliver, because there's nothing for the Lord to deliver by many or by few. So let's go see what the Lord might want to do. And obviously, how much they loved the Lord. And you have to love this about both David and Jonathan. And we'll see this in particular with David this evening, but both of them men of great humility. As for Jonathan, his great humility, he's the son of the king, which would mean he's the prince, which would mean he's in line for the kingdom. This would be a dynastic kind of a situation, and he doesn't seem to care. It's great humility about the man. And really the other thing, that as the soul of both of these two were so knit together, they were the opposite of Saul in nearly every single way. Again, the world really wants to make, and this is where it's so sad and not shocking about the world and what the world gives and pushes and suggests. Everything is carnal. And not just, you know, sexual in those terms, but carnal. Everything's about the flesh, because if I don't believe in God and I deliberately, aggressively want to, remember Romans chapter 1, I want to eliminate him from even my thinking, what remains? Like material stuff. There's nothing spiritual, there's nothing divine, there's no miracles. So what remains? Physical stuff, our bodies and everything else that's just a material, fleshly substance. And so the world, that's all they have. But this true love, and love like this with these friends, it's not interested in that, or it's not limited to the material things. It's way greater than that. And I would say, just in the simplest terms, these two men, they are the epitome, and they epitomize what best friends look like and how they work. It's a beautiful thing here. Verse 4. So Jonathan, he took off the robe that was on him, and he gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword and his bow and his belt. And you wonder how much, at this point especially, how much Jonathan might have known both about Dad, that he's not going to be the king anymore, and did he know anything about David? Like, likely not. Did he know that David was going to become the king? But I want you to have these things. And just an interesting contrast here. Think about, actually, take a second. You have a Bible in front of you. 10 seconds. Read verse 4 again. Just read it on your own. Does this not provide a little bit? I didn't give you a whole 10 seconds. I'm so sorry. It provides an interesting contrast, doesn't it? Because it's not exact, but if you remember chapter 17, these here in chapter 18, these elements, these implements David receives from Jonathan, in chapter 17, when Saul says, put on my armor, it was no use to David. Interesting. And do what you want with that, just a kind of an observational note, but interesting contrast. Here with this friendship, David receives this. Chapter 17, I've not tested these. I can't even walk in these things, and they're not going to work. Interesting. Verse 5. So David went out wherever Saul sent him, and he behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servant. Real quick note here with this, of course. How old's David at this point? Not very old at all. He's likely a teenager. Interesting. But Saul trusts him to some degree. Verse 6. Now it happened as they were coming home, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, or some of your translations will render it Philistines, that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. Notice the text, the words of the song, the lyrics. So the women sang as they danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000. Stop right there. Don't look any further. Any guesses? If you read ahead, tisk, tisk. But, you know, how do you think this, without getting all psychological and everything else, how do you think this made Saul feel? I mean, look at the lyrics again. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Now, New Testament, we are to rejoice with those who rejoice. So this is what I would expect from Saul at that point. He, you know, maybe doesn't mind this. I keep reading. Oh no, I guessed poorly. Verse 8, then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him. And he said, and he says it, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, And to me they've ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? And he eyed David from that day forward, sort of viewed him with suspicion. And maybe your translation renders it exactly that way. Viewed him suspiciously. And this would almost be like, I'll bet this guy's trying to take the kingdom from me. Now, it's really interesting here. And just as I read the text, what's not told us in verse 8, is he speaking to himself? Is he just in his courtroom saying this and people are overhearing it? Does he speak to someone else? Like, who exactly is hearing this from the king? But it's now coming out of his mouth how upset and angry he is. And then the question that he asks there, now what more can he, David, have but the kingdom? Well, in chapter 16, David was anointed as king. And at the end of chapter 17, if you remember, and we just read it a few minutes ago, he doesn't even really know who David is, let alone would he know that David had been anointed king. He wouldn't have known any of that. But what we do know, and what of course Saul knew, was chapter 15 and verse 27. Look, man, the kingdom is pulled from you. It's taken from you. It's no longer yours. And Saul knew this. He knew this wasn't his kingdom. So the question that he asks here in verse 8 of chapter 18, and this thought in his head, David's going to steal this from me, even though it's no longer mine. And if I serve the Lord, it never was mine in the first place. But you start to see kind of the chaos of Saul coming to the forefront here. And we don't even know if he's speaking to someone directly as he's just wondering about all these things in his anger. Verse 10, it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God, we saw that a couple chapters ago, came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. That's interesting. We'll see some more of that in just a little bit here. So David played music with his hand as at other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand, like dun dun dun. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, this is not just a spur of the moment kind of thing. He's obviously thinking about this. I will pin David to the wall. But David escaped his presence twice. Quick note here, twice this is going to happen again. This is the first time, but there'll be another time. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, I'll pin David to the wall. David escaped his presence twice. Now Saul was afraid of David. Why? Because the Lord was with him, but he had departed, the Lord had departed from Saul. I'll give you a quick quote from the great old commentator Matthew Henry. Now begin David's troubles. And they not only tread on the heels of his triumphs, but take rise from them. Such is the vanity of that in this world which seems greatest. It's because he had done so well. It's because he had victory. It's because of this, as Matthew Henry would say it, he had these triumphs. And that's the thing that caused Saul to say, wait a minute, David's killed. You're singing about him killing 10,000, and you've only singing about me killing thousands? Well, this stinks and I'm going to kill the guy. Some level of paranoia here. And I know I've mentioned this before on Wednesday nights as we're studying for Samuel, you know, on our once a month Saturday morning men's Bible study. We started this, I don't know, year and a half ago, 2 years ago, whatever it was. And we're working through 1 Samuel. And I'll tell you, every week, right when we're studying through 1 Samuel, like, what is the deal with Saul? Like, there's some weeks like, hey, good job, Saul. You know, you want to pat the guy in the back, like, your honor, you know, long live the king kind of thing, but great job there. And other weeks it's like, what are you doing? And this is one of these moments. This absolute paranoia. Notice again, verse 9, though. He eyed David or viewed him with suspicion from that day forward. What seems to be true here of Saul is that he seems to assume, and I want to make sure that I'm clear on what I believe is happening here, because it's Saul, and like, so how can I know exactly what's happening in another person's mind or heart, right? But what seems to be the case, he seems to assume that David is just like him, power hungry, trying to hold on to, if I have a position, I need to hold on to it. And now they're singing about this kid. It's one thing that he killed Goliath, and everyone knows it, and now he's coming for my kingdom. But it's David. David, he didn't care. David was convinced, man, I just want to serve the Lord. If the Lord wants me, even when he was, do you remember this? We talked about this when we were studying chapter 17, then we had our great discussion about it. What a great time that was. But even when David left to go bring these goods to his brothers, he made sure that the sheep were tended. Like, I'll go take care of my brothers, but make sure someone's taking care of the sheep before I leave. If the Lord had asked him to be a shepherd for the rest of his life, he would have done so. Saul, again, this seems to be the case as I'm viewing it. Saul makes the assumption that David's just like me. And upon the simplest of examinations, it's clear that David has no real concern for power, and we'll see this even more clearly in a few moments. So Saul's throwing spears. David escapes. Saul's afraid of David because the Lord's with him, and therefore, verse 13, notice the therefore, this is important. Therefore, Saul removed him from his presence, David, and made him his captain over 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. It's interesting, right? Like, okay, wait a minute. If I'm reading it correctly, tell me if you, like, raise your hand or something right now, but like, am I reading this wrong? Did David not just get a pretty great promotion? Okay, so here, you're promoted. Why? It tells us. The therefore is, I don't even want to see this guy. I want him out of my presence. Why was he in his presence in the first place? When this distressing spirit would come upon him, David would come and play music, and it would settle Saul's spirit. And at this point, even the music isn't helping. In fact, Saul is so out of sorts that it's instigating him without David trying. Because of Saul's assumptions, he's viewing David, this kid's coming for my kingdom. I don't even want him in my presence. So therefore, he's leaving. I need him to leave. And Saul loathed the mere sight of David. This is David, the killer of the giant, the player of the harp. But, man, he went out and came in before the people. You think the people loved him? They're singing songs about him. And David, verse 14, behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. I love that that's repeated. And therefore, when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. But, huge contrast here in verse 16, but all Israel and Judah loved David. Why? Because he went out and came in before him. If I can put this into kind of three basic simple categories, and they're essentially interconnected. The people loved him because, number one, he served them, not himself. He wasn't making statues of himself. He was serving the people and putting his life at risk. He served the people. He didn't serve himself. Secondly, he wasn't changed by his title or his permission, or not his permission, his promotion or his position. Like, all these great things, and then connected to title and position and promotion would be privilege. This is a pretty good gig that he's got, but he didn't seem to be changed by it. And I think the people saw that. And thirdly, I think this is, again, it's all interconnected. As the Lord was clearly with him, and everyone could see that he behaved himself how he should have behaved himself, they loved him. I think it's because the people knew that he was one of them. He was just one of us. He didn't take himself too seriously. He took his work seriously. What was set before him to do. Like, he loved and respected Saul. And this was what was set before him to do. But none of it changed him. And he was just one of the people, and they knew it. And then verse 17, Saul said to David, here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you as a wife, Only be valiant, notice the wording, for me, and fight the Lord's battles. He includes the Lord there. For Saul thought, this is fascinating, like, gee, Saul, why do you say that? For Saul thought, let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. Thanks, Dad. Right? So I'd like you to be my son-in-law here. And like, why is he doing this? Partially because, do you remember in chapter 17? Whoever kills the giant is going to receive, among other things, my daughter's hand in marriage. And the whole free from taxes thing was a pretty great bonus as well. But really fascinating that Saul is thinking this way. I can't do anything. Let not my hand be against him. But I'll let the Philistines deal with him for me. What's amazing to me about this is, again, we can't really know the mind of someone else. But what we're given here, the way I'm seeing this and my understanding of Saul here, he seems to expect the worst. And he seems to assume for David that defeat awaits. I can't kill him, but if I send him off to battle, one of these days, certainly, eventually, I mean, for pity's sake, eventually the Philistines are going to get him. And the Philistines obviously hate the guy. He killed their great leader. You know, he killed the giant. So I'll let the Philistines do my dirty work for me. He just assumes defeat. And so David said to Saul, well, who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be son-in-law to the king? Sir, I'm a nobody. But it happened at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel the Mahalothite as a wife. Now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. And so Saul said, verse 21, I will give her to him, thanks, Dad, that she may be a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore Saul said to David a second time, You shall be my son-in-law today. Verse 22, and Saul commanded his servants, communicate with David secretly and say, look, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now therefore become the king's son-in-law. And so Saul's servants spoke these words in the hearing of David. And David said, does it seem to you a light thing to be a king's son-in-law, seeing I am a poor and lightly esteemed man? There's several things here, of course. I mean, the first obvious thing, like if you're David, what are you thinking? Like, okay, so the other day, I get a promotion. I don't know why, but 5 minutes before the promotion, the king's trying to kill me, and now he wants me to be part of the family. If I'm David, I'm a little confused at this point. But even in all of that, and I mentioned this a few moments ago, what is so abundantly clear, David has no concern for power. He's not interested in that. In fact, he has obviously great respect for the king, even though the king has so mistreated him. He has great respect for the family of the king, and he has the great respect for the honor that's associated with it. That's why he's not saying this with any kind of guile in verse 23. He's speaking to the servants. Like, you guys are saying this like it's no big deal, but does it seem like a light thing that you'd be marrying into the king's family? And I'm a nobody, and no offense to my dad, you know, Jesse and the family, but we're nobodies. And that you would just think that you can communicate this, and I'll be like, oh, okay, no big deal. It's a big deal. And he didn't take it lightly, nor did he seek it. He was not looking for ways to kind of worm his way into power and position. He didn't want it. He viewed himself as a nobody. And as a nobody, he knew, and I love this about David, and I hope this is true for every single one of us. He knew that as a nobody, if God could use him, it would be because God used him. I get so concerned all the time with, like, you hear some great athlete or, you know, some famous person get saved. Like, okay, now God can do something amazing because look at how great this person is. Like, actually, God kind of specializes in using nobodies because nobodies don't try to take the credit for it. And you see someone great, like, well, obviously God's going to use them. You know, the rest of us, we'll never be used at all because we're nobodies. But that person, like, I think David's, I am a nobody. Does it seem a light thing to you? There in verse 23 again. To be a king's son-in-law, seeing I am a poor and lightly esteemed man. And so Saul's servants relay this to the king, verse 24. The servants of Saul told him, saying, in this manner David spoke. And then Saul said, thus you shall say to David. And this is so weird, right? So it's like messengers seem to be going back and forth because I don't want to see even have the guy in my presence. So go tell him, the king does not desire any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Okay. And yes, you appreciate that you're on that side of the pulpit, not on this side of the pulpit. Thank you very much. Like, that's in the Bible? Apparently that's in the Bible. But why is that in the Bible? Because that's in the heart and mind of Saul. It doesn't pretty up any of this. And there's so much of us like, no, this is the first king of Israel. We kind of need to make him look as best as we can. Like, how twisted is this? I don't even know. The twisted man, and no doubt, as he said earlier, right, back it up to verse 17 for a second. You remember this when he was thinking about offering his daughter Merab. Let my hand not be against him, against David, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. And then ultimately, oh, where is it? Is it in verse 21? Yeah, when he's now thinking of his daughter, his other daughter, Michal. So Saul said, I will give her to him so that she may be a snare to him, which is interesting as we'll read more about her later, but that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. And so is this what he's been thinking all along? How can I get the hand of the Philistines against him? By requiring this as the worst dowry you've ever heard in your entire life. Like, I'll just get the Philistines to get him. And I imagined, I don't think I have to imagine very, very diligently here, but I would think that this kind of thing would enrage any enemy, right? You're not going to make your enemies real happy with that kind of thing. Saul just so twisted. So when his servants, verse 26, told David these words, it pleased David well to become the king's son-in-law, because I guess the king respects me. And now the days had not expired, and therefore David arose and went, he and his men, and they killed 200 men of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full count. Like, who's the person in charge of counting? This is terrible. And they gave them in full count to the king. I didn't write it. And then, so that he might become the king's son-in-law. And then Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, as a wife. And thus Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, again repeated just in this chapter, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. And Saul was still more afraid of David, and Saul became David's enemy continually, or maybe your translation renders it something like all the days or all the days of his life. What's happening here? Saul sees what everyone else sees. God's hand is upon this man's life, and even the worst order that I could give him isn't going to stop him. And that causes fear. And it's a little bit of a side note, but it's a side note, I suppose, for spiritual leadership, though it seems weird in the context. Saul sees what everyone else sees. In other words, people should see and know that God is calling a person to full-time service. Like, everyone should see it. Back in the day when we were at the Bible school and we, you know, worked with the missions training program, I used to remind the missions training program students that there's a difference between someone who went and someone who was sent. I'm just going to go do something. Is anyone backing you on this? Is there church leadership behind you? No, I'm just going to do what I, like Lone Ranger kind of leadership. There's this recognition, and all the people loved him because he went out before them. They knew this. You couldn't stop the guy because the Lord was with him. Saul was seeing what everyone else was seeing. Everyone recognized this in David, and that caused David to become Saul's enemy. And that's an important note. We'll see that more. I'm assuming we'll actually get further into these chapters this evening. But don't miss that, because it's really tragic. David's doing everything right, and Saul is making David his enemy. Saul's the one instigating this for no cause. But it's also worth the note here, and I don't know if you caught this, in this chapter alone, verse 29 marks the third time that we're told of Saul's, did you catch this? His fear. He was afraid of David. You saw this in verse 12. You saw it in verse 15. And you see it here in verse 29. In verse 12, it tells us he was afraid because the Lord was with him, was with David. In verse 15, it's because David behaved wisely. He's doing things the right way. And here in verse 29, again, the Lord is with him. And his own daughter loves him. My own family loves this guy. And I'm wondering, again, if you could try to get into the head of Saul. Is he thinking, this man, I can't compete with any of this. I can't stop this guy. I send him into the teeth of the enemy, and he's victorious over and over and over. And the Lord is with him every step of the way. And Saul must have known, I'm paling in comparison to this man of whom the kingdom is singing songs. I'm just thrilled that they're saying anything about any of my victories compared to all that David's doing. Again, he doesn't rejoice. He instead fears, expects, and believes the worst. And Saul, as we'll see in these chapters, responds, and we see it here so clearly, responds by making David his enemy. And even worse for Saul, David's greatness and reputation grew. Notice verse 30. Then the princes of the Philistines went out to war, and so it was whenever they went out that David behaved more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name became highly esteemed. Like, it's getting worse for Saul. The spear was the best thing he could try, and that's not even working. Chapter 19 tells us, now Saul spoke to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. Like, I can't do it, so can you guys do it? I can't do it, the Philistines can't do it, so can you guys do it? They should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. They're best friends, right? And Jonathan, I don't even know how to say this, and like when I was putting my notes together, my thoughts together, Jonathan in a bit of a tough spot, because he's kind of forced to choose sides while not choosing sides. I mean, my dad's the king. I guess I'm supposed to take orders from dad, and he's the king. But David's my best friend, and the Lord's clearly with him, so what on earth am I supposed to do here? And so Jonathan, verse 2, told David, saying, I wonder what his tone of voice was. So, hey, I just want to let you know that my father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide. Let's just get through the night. And I will go out and stand before my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. Then what I observe, I will tell you. Essentially, he's telling David, like, well, you hide, and I'm going to see if I can convince dad otherwise that, no, I don't think you should kill David. So verse 4, thus Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you and because his works have been very good toward you. And then he gives example, right? For he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it. Like, Dad, this was just a couple chapters ago. You saw it, and you rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause? In modern vernacular, we would say he's trying to talk some sense into his dad. Like, Dad, what you're trying to do makes no sense whatsoever. You saw all of this yourself. You witnessed this. You rejoiced with this. And this is how you're going to respond, by putting him to death? So again, without reading ahead, How would you now expect that Saul is going to respond to this? Verse 6. So Saul was thrown into a rage? No. So Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be killed. Okay, so that wasn't very expected. I mean, good news at this point in the story, but very unexpected. And again, this erratic behavior and these erratic impulses, and how about this? We've seen this before from Saul. What else? As the Lord lives, erratic oaths. As though I swear on the Lord, he will not be. Whoa. He's all over the place. Like, you're right, son. There's no reason to kill him. As the Lord lives, he shall not be killed. So then Jonathan, verse 7, called David, and Jonathan told him all these things. And so Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence, as in times past, like the good old days, like pre-spear-throwing days, I suppose. And there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him. And again, this is a little bit of a side note, but do you remember this when we talked about it in chapter 17? We tend to think, here's the giant, he killed Goliath, and now all the problems just blew away. There are still Philistines. Great victory, and still battles to be fought and battles to be won. There's war again. And so David, he strikes them. They flee from him. And now verse 9, the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. Like, you needed someone in that court to just say, hey, let me hang on to the spear for you, sir, you know. And David was playing music with his hand. It's another note, bless you, but it's worth the mention there in verse 9. Again, take a couple seconds and look at it and see if this sounds familiar with what we've observed from Saul in the past. What's happening in the immediate context there in verses 8 and 9? There's war. David goes and fights. Saul has a spear in his hand. But what is he doing? As he sat, where? In his house. Jonathan, a man of action. David, a man of action. Abner, even. It's war again. Like, you appreciate that Saul's holding a spear, but sitting at home holding a spear? I wonder if Saul is simply trying to look the part. And again, this distressing spirit, yet again. But at this point, David's music, not of any real help for Saul. And again, it would seem that Saul is digressing here. So he's playing music. Verse 10. Then Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped, this is the second time, but slipped away from Saul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall. So what kind of walls and all that, who knows, but there's some fury, some might behind this. So David fled and escaped that night. Notice verse 11. Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you don't save your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed. So again, remember Jonathan trying to take sides without taking sides, and now Jonathan's sister Michal, David's wife, so Jonathan's now his brother-in-law, and now she's taking sides without taking sides. So, hey, sweetheart, love you so much. So, funniest thing, we'll laugh about this later, Dad wants to kill you, so you need to, if you don't escape tonight, by tomorrow you'll be dead. And I love you. I don't know. So, Michal, verse 12, let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. That sounds like Paul at some point in the book of Acts. And what's interesting about that, I need to not camp on this at all, but you want some big miraculous or heroic, and David fought off all these, he escapes through a window. Remember Saul? Through the city, the window of the city walls, in a basket. I think it was in one of the letters to the Corinthians that he talks about that. I escaped in a basket. Like, about the most humiliating, just, man, get in a basket, lower you down. So David escapes for his life. There's nothing valiant here. He's just trying to stay alive. He escapes at verse 13. And Michal took an image or an idol, a household idol, and laid it in the bed put a cover of goat's hair for his head and covered it with clothes. This is the old, my husband's definitely is, because look, you know, there's someone definitely in the bed there. And, you know, again, in the men's study a couple months ago, someone asked, I think it was Jake, asked this question, hey, why is there an idol in her house? And this takes me back to maybe what Saul was referencing in chapter 18 when he was talking about Michal, that she might be a snare to him. I don't know, but I wonder, especially because those two events are so closely related just in the context of these chapters. Why is there an idol in her house? How about this? Why isn't there an idol in their house? Now, some commentators will tell you that in those days, it wasn't necessarily a pagan kind of a thing. It wasn't necessarily idolatrous in that manner, but maybe it was just some kind of representation of the Lord. Either way, I'm pretty sure they weren't supposed to be making idols. So if you want to try to make something nice of this, it shouldn't have been there. Big context, this is relatively the time of the judges. We're now into the time of the kings, but everyone had been doing what was right in their own eyes. So Saul, obviously not the godliest guy. His family, apparently not completely godly either. And so as much as we look at this and think, how about that Michal? I don't know. Apparently there was some further sanctification needed in her life. And before we get too down on Michal here about is there any further sanctification needed in your life tonight? Let's move forward, right? Verse 14. It just stinks that, like, they get their stories told in the Bible. This is several thousand years later. We're like, how about that Saul? Like, what are people... imagine if your life was recorded by the Holy Spirit, like, in thousands of years, like, and Jeremy did this, and people are like, are you kidding me? Or like, yeah, actually, that fits, you know. So, Verse 14. So there's the pretending like it's David in the bed there. So when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he's sick. I love this. Then Saul sent the messengers back. So they must have said, sir, we went to go kill him as you instructed, but your daughter said he's sick, so we thought we should just let him get... So it says that he sent him back, right? He sent the messengers back to see David saying, bring him up to me in the bed that I may kill him. I'm going to do this. If you guys can't... I'm going to kill him myself. So verse 16, when the messengers had come in, there was the image in the bed with a cover of goat's hair for his head. They got him. And so Saul said to Michal, why have you deceived me like this and sent, here it is again, my enemy away so that he has escaped? And Michal answered Saul, her dad, he said to me, let me go, why should I kill you? Okay, that's not really, of course, what happened. And before, again, we get too down on Michal here, it's she's scared of her dad at this point, and his messengers are now in her bedroom trying to kill her husband. And again, Saul had made David, for no logical reason, his enemy. And what's so fascinating about the mindset of Saul here, did you notice that in verse 17? What bothers him? Daughter, you've tried to deceive me. Okay, so you're justifying your hatred that's leading you to commit murder. But I guess when you walk away from the Lord, things can get pretty dicey pretty quickly. And you can justify a lot of stuff and be upset about someone else's deception when you're engaged in attempted murder. So David fled and escaped, and he went to Samuel at Ramah. And he told him, so he's catching up with Samuel here, he told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed at Na'ioth. And it was told Saul, saying, take note, David is at Na'ioth in Ramah. And then Saul sent messengers to take David. And by the way, just a quick note here, something about verse 18, it's so simple, but don't miss it. David goes to visit Samuel, and he tells Samuel all that Saul had done to him. Here's my one line of commentary. Sometimes the best medicine is time spent with an old friend or an old mentor. How you doing, David? Not great. And he tells him all that had happened. So Saul sends these messengers, and verse 20, he sent messengers to take David. When they saw the group of prophets prophesying and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. And when Saul was told, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. And then Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they prophesied also. Now, this is likely not any sort of predictive prophecy. It's not like this is what's going to happen in the future kind of thing. This would be words from the Lord to those present in that place at that time. And no doubt, I would think that this word of prophecy would have been to these messengers themselves that are doing the work for this king. And since these messengers are part of the kingdom of Israel, what did everyone in the kingdom of Israel know about David? He's an amazing guy. So where Jonathan is forced and Michal are forced to not take sides while taking sides, now these men are in this position of, so David's killed Goliath, right. Killed 10,000, right. Killed those 200 guys. And there's other wars that happened. And Saul wants to kill him, and he's now sending us to go kill him. I guess we go do that because the king tells, like, they're wondering, and I wonder if the word of prophecy to them was something specific saying, like, what are you doing here? The kind of doctrinal or doctrinal takeaway from some of this is simply this. All of it is unusual. Like, take your Bible memories here. In the Old Testament, do you read anything really like this? You know, or how often do you find something like this that would say this is definitely normal? In the Gospels, do you find anything like this? In the book of Acts, do you find people that are essentially the enemies of the Lord here doing this kind of thing? In the New Testament epistles, do we find instruction on this specific type of behavior, like this is something you should expect? Well, of course we find the gift of prophecy, yes, but not like this. So again, from a doctrinal or doctrinal standpoint, this is very unusual. So the takeaway would simply be this. Don't try to make any doctrinal kind of statement from this. You can be okay with it's very unusual. As in, you shouldn't expect this to be practiced, and the Lord is, check my theology here, the Lord is the Lord. God is the Lord, and He does what He pleases. And the reason behind this unusual prophetic activity seems to be twofold. Number one, I'm going to say it's merciful protection. And number two, it's protective mercy. Number one, it's merciful protection. And number two, it's protective mercy. Like, that's just cute semantics, Jeremy. You're not fooling anyone. Well, I would think the merciful protection would be for David. Saul is sending, he's now on the run, and he's sending it not just to go to his house and kill him. I've got people following him to kill him, and he's protecting David. This is to save his life. It's merciful protection. As for the protective mercy, I would think it's for these three groups of men to come into contact with the true and living God in a powerful way. I wonder if it's kind of one of these moments. What are we doing here that they experience the Lord in that kind of way? This is protective mercy for them to come to their senses. And then the same thing for Saul, apparently, verse 22. He also went to Ramah, and he came to the great well that is in Sehu. And so he asked and said, "Where are Samuel and David?" And someone said, "Indeed, they're at Naioth in Ramah." And so he went there to Naioth in Ramah. And then the Spirit of God was upon him also. And he went on and prophesied until he came to Naioth in Ramah. Also, verse 24, and I'll give you a quick note about this. It's important. He stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? The quick note here, the Hebrew, the connotation would be more down to his undergarments. And the reason is likely simply this, like, why would he strip off his clothing? Why is he just kind of down to that? Because what would Saul have been, like, give yourself a second and think about this. What would Saul have been wearing up to this point? If your answer is clothing, like, yes, very good, that's correct. But what kind of clothing, what type of clothing? And if your answer is kingly, you'd probably be correct. So why would he strip off his kingly royal attire? Why indeed was not his kingdom stripped from him way earlier than this. And he's now going after the next king. And I wonder if the Spirit of the Lord is saying, not so much. Stripped of his royal look since he was no longer a king. Again, for Saul, this is humbling. And this unusual, and again, merciful and powerful experience for Saul is definitely that. It's this humbling, breaking kind of thing for him. Saul, I know you think you're calling the shots, but you're actually going to speak on my behalf now, and we don't know what he says. So my encouragement might be, get a commentary or two or five and dig into it a little bit. Dig into it a little bit. Is the gift of prophecy available for today? According to the New Testament, it absolutely is. Does that mean there'll be predictive prophecy? That's not the point of it. That's not what we have in terms of what's to come is already given to us in the Scriptures. I suppose that's another conversation for another time. But as for this, and I was hoping to do obviously chapter 20 this evening, I will spare you that. But the last thing here in verse 20, notice the end of the chapter. It ends with a question, is Saul also among the prophets? And my tone is probably accurate for what it is, because therefore they say is kind of, it almost became like a proverb. Is Saul also among the prophets? It's almost like it became this byword or this catchphrase. Everyone's shocked. They say this would be something that you would say when you're completely shocked by something, or when something happens that's completely unexpected, unusual, or how about this? It's pretty unlikely. Like the likelihood, because who's the leader of the prophets? Samuel. And that, wait a minute, you're telling me that Saul is one of the prophets? And your answer being, no, that's not likely. And that would be unusual if that happened. That's really unlikely. That's unexpected. And it became like this proverb. And maybe we can start using that in our common vernacular today. Like when something weird happens, man, is Saul among the prophets? And people are going to, what? And like, it's a Bible expression. You had to be there. But it was so out. And how about that? Like, where is Saul that him acting in a prophetic manner is so out of place? Like, how tragic is this that people make a proverb out of it? They started saying, is he one of the prophets? No way. Not the guy that's trying to kill the guy that killed Goliath. Not the guy that's trying to kill the guy that married his daughter. Not the guy that's trying to kill the guy that's best friends with his son. Not the guy that's trying to kill the guy that the people of Israel are singing that he's killed his 10,000. No, there's no way he's acting in a prophetic manner. How tragic. How the mighty had fallen and Saul still had some falling yet to go. We'll pick it up in chapter 20 and 20. We'll get into 21 in a couple weeks. Next week, Pastor Craig is with us. Thanks for being here tonight. Have a great night. And there's cookies at the coffee counter. Enjoy some Christmas and New Year's cookies. God bless you. Have a great night. See you later.